Culture Mobile, an employee initiative of the BMW Group since 2003. The literature podcast of Culture Mobile. For many decades now, the publishing house Alfred A. Knopf ran out of New York and London has published The Everyman's Library. And in it, all the short stories by William Somerset Maugham are published in one volume, which is close to 900 pages long. William Somerset Maugham was an English writer born in 1874, passed away in 1965. He was orphaned at a very early age, but became a very, very affluent writer because he was very widely read and was very well known, and he also wrote a lot. And I found a story that was published first in Cosmopolitan magazine in 1929, and it is called The Bum. It is somewhat biographic because it is about a writer who is stranded in Veracruz because of a strike, and he encounters a bum that finally he realizes after he sees him again and again that he knows him from somewhere. So I won't give away more than that. Enjoy W. Somerset Maugham, The Bum. God knows how often I had lamented that I had not half the time I needed to do half the things I wanted. I could not remember when last I had had a moment to myself. I had often amused my fancy with the prospect of just 1 week's complete idleness. Most of us, when not busy working, are busy playing. We ride, play tennis or golf, swim or gamble. But I saw myself doing nothing at all. I would lounge through the morning, dawdle through the afternoon, and loaf through the evening. My mind would be a slate, and each passing hour a sponge that wiped out the scribblings written on it by the world of sense. Time, because it is so fleeting, time, because it is beyond recall, is the most precious of human goods, and to squander it is the most delicate form of dissipation in which man can indulge. Cleopatra dissolved in wine a priceless pearl, but she gave it to Antony to drink. When you waste the brief golden hours, you take the beaker in which the gem is melted and dash its contents to the ground. The gesture is grand, like all grand gestures, absurd. That, of course, is an excuse. In the week I promised myself, I should naturally read, for to the habitual reader, reading is a drug of which he is the slave. Deprive him of printed matter, and he grows nervous, moody, and restless. Then, like the alcoholic bereft of brandy, who will drink shellac or methylated spirit, he will make do with the advertisements of a paper 5 years old. He will make do with a telephone directory. But the professional writer is seldom a disinterested reader. I wished my reading to be but another form of idleness. I made up my mind that if ever the happy day arrived when I could enjoy untroubled leisure, I would complete an enterprise that had always tempted me, but which hitherto, like an explorer making reconnaissances into an undiscovered country, I had done little more than enter upon. I would read the entire works of Nick Carter. But I'd always fancied myself choosing my moment with surroundings to my liking, not having it forced upon me. And when I was suddenly faced with nothing to do and had to make the best of it, like a steamship acquaintance whom in the wide waste of the Pacific Ocean you have invited to stay with you in London and who turns up without warning and with all his luggage, I was not a little taken aback. I had come to Veracruz from Mexico City to catch one of the Ward Company's white, cool ships to Yucatan, and found to my dismay that, a dock strike having been declared overnight, my ship would not put in. I was stuck in Veracruz. I took a room in the Hotel Diligencias overlooking the plaza, and spent the morning looking at the sights of the town. I wandered down side streets and peeped into quaint courts. I sauntered through the parish church. It is picturesque with its gargoyles and flying buttresses, and the salt wind and the blazing sun have patinated its harsh and massive walls with the mellowness of age. Its cupola is covered with white and blue tiles, Then I found that I had seen all that was to be seen, and I sat down in the coolness of the arcade that surrounded the square and ordered a drink. The sun beat down on the plaza with a merciless splendor. The cocoa palms drooped dusty and bedraggled. Great black buzzards perched on them for a moment uneasily, swooped to the ground to gather some bit of offal, and then, with lumbering wings, flew up to the church tower. I watched the people crossing the square, Negroes, Indians, Creoles, and Spanish, the motley people of the Spanish Main, and they varied in color from ebony to ivory. As the morning wore on, the tables around me filled up, chiefly with men, who had come to have a drink before luncheon, for the most part in white ducks, but some notwithstanding the heat and the dark glows of professional respectability. A small band, a guitarist, a blind fiddler, and a harpist played ragtime, and after every other tune, the guitarist came around with a plate. I had already bought the local paper, and I was adamant to the news vendors who pertinaciously sought to sell me more copies of the same sheet. I refused, oh, 20 times at least, the solicitations of grimy urchins who wanted to shine my spotless shoes. And having come to the end of my small change, I could only shake my head at the beggars who imported me. They gave one no peace. Little Indian women in shapeless rags, each one with a baby tied in the shawl on her neck, held out skinny hands and in a whimper recited a dismal screed. Blind men were led up to my table by small boys. The maimed, the halt, the deformed exhibited the sores and the monstrosities with which nature or accident had afflicted them. And half-naked, underfed children whined endlessly their demands for coppers. But these kept their eyes open for the fat policeman, who would suddenly dart out on them with a thong and give them a sharp cut on the back or over the head. Then they would scamper, only to return again when, exhausted by the exercise of so much energy, he relapsed into lethargy. But suddenly my attention was attracted by a beggar who, unlike the rest of them, and indeed the people sitting around me, swarthy and black-haired, had hair and beard of a red so vivid that it was startling. His beard was ragged, and his long mop of hair looked as though it had not been brushed for months. He wore only a pair of trousers and a cotton singlet, but they were tatters, grimy and foul, that barely held together. I have never seen anyone so thin. His legs, his naked arms, were but skin and bone, and through the rents of his singlet you saw every rib of his wasted body. You could count the bones of his dust-covered feet. Of that starveling band he was easily the most abject. He was not old. He could not well have been more than 40. And I could not but ask myself what had brought him to this pass. It was absurd to think that he would not have worked, if work he had been able to get. He was the only one of the beggars who did not speak. The rest of them poured forth their litany of woe, and if it did not bring the alms they asked, continued until an impatient word from you chased them away. He said nothing. I suppose he felt that his look of destitution was all the appeal he needed. He did not even hold out his hand. He merely looked at you. But with such wretchedness in his eyes, such despair in his attitude, it was dreadful. He stood on and on, silent and immobile, gazing steadfastly, and then, if you took no notice of him, he moved slowly to the next table. If he was given nothing, he showed neither disappointment nor anger. If someone offered him a coin, he stepped forward a little, stretched out his claw-like hand, took it without a word of thanks, and impassively went his way. I had nothing to give him, and when he came to me, so that he should not wait in vain, I shook my head. Dispense usted por Dios, I said, using the polite Castilian formula with which the Spaniards refuse a beggar. But he paid no attention to what I said. He stood in front of me, for as long as he stood at the other tables, looking at me with tragic eyes. I have never seen such a wreck of humanity. There was something terrifying in his appearance. He did not look quite sane. At length, he passed on. It was 1 o'clock, and I had lunch. When I awoke from my siesta, It was still very hot, but towards evening a breath of air coming in through the windows, which I had at last ventured to open, tempted me into the plaza. I sat down under my arcade and ordered a long drink. Presently, people in greater numbers filtered into the open space from the surrounding streets. The tables in the restaurants round it filled up, and in the kiosk in the middle the band began to play. The crowd grew thicker. On the free benches, people sat huddled together like dark grapes clustered on a stalk. There was a lively hum of conversation. The big black buzzards flew screeching overhead, swooping down when they saw something to pick up or scurrying away from under the feet of the passersby. As twilight descended, they swarmed, it seemed from all parts of the town, towards the church tower. They circled heavily about it and, hoarsely crying, squabbling and jangling, settled themselves uneasily to roost. And again bootblacks begged me to have my shoes cleaned. Newsboys pressed dank papers upon me. Beggars whined their plaintive demand for alms. I saw once more that strange red-bearded fellow, and watched him stand motionless with a crushed and piteous air before one table after another. He did not stop before mine. I supposed he remembered me from the morning, and having failed to get anything from me, then thought it useless to try again. You do not often see a red-haired Mexican, and because it was only in Russia that I had seen men of so destitute a mien, I asked myself if he was by chance a Russian. It accorded well enough with the Russian fecklessness that he should have allowed himself to sink to such a depth of degradation. Yet he had not a Russian face. His emaciated features were clear-cut, and his blue eyes were not set in the head in a Russian manner. I wondered if he could be a sailor, English, Scandinavian, or American, who had deserted his ship and by degrees sunk to this pitiful condition. He disappeared. Since there was nothing else to do, I stayed on till I got hungry, and when I had eaten, came back. I sat on till the thinning crowd suggested it was bedtime. I confess that the day had seemed long, and I wondered how many similar days I should be forced to spend there. But I woke after a little while and could not get to sleep again. My room was stifling. I opened the shutters and looked out at the church. There was no moon, but the bright stars faintly lit its outline. The buzzards were closely packed on the cross above the cupola and on the edges of the tower, and now and then they moved a little. The effect was uncanny. And then, I have no notion why, that red scarecrow recurred to my mind, and I had suddenly a strange feeling that I had seen him before. It was so vivid that it drove away from me the possibility of sleep. I felt sure that I had come across him, but when and where I could not tell. I tried to picture the surroundings in which he might take place. But I could see no more than a dim figure against a background of fog. As the dawn approached, it grew a little cooler, and I was able to sleep. I spent my second day at Veracruz as I had spent the first. But I watched for the coming of the red-haired beggar, and as he stood at the tables near mine, I examined him with attention. I felt certain now that I had seen him somewhere. I even felt certain that I had known him and talked to him, but I still could recall none of the circumstances. Once more he passed my table without stopping, and when his eyes met mine, I looked in them for some gleam of recollection. Nothing. I wondered if I had made a mistake, and thought I had seen him in the same way as sometimes, by some queer motion of the brain, in the act of doing something you are convinced that you are repeating an action that you have done at some past time. I could not get out of my head the impression that at some moment he had entered into my life. I racked my brains. I was sure now that he was either English or American, but I was shy of addressing him. I went over in my mind the possible occasions when I might have met him. Not to be able to place him exasperated me, as it does when you try to remember a name that is on the tip of your tongue and yet eludes you. The day wore on. Another day came, another morning, another evening. It was Sunday, and the plaza was more crowded than ever. The tables on the arcade were packed. As usual, the red-haired beggar came along, a terrifying figure in his silence, his threadbare rags, and his pitiful distress. He was standing in front of a table only two from mine, mutely beseeching but without a gesture. Then I saw the policemen, who at intervals tried to protect the public from the importunities of all these beggars, sneak around a column and give him a resounding whack with his thong. His thin body winced, but he made no protest and showed no resentment. He seemed to accept the stinging blow as in the ordinary course of things, and with his slow movements slunk away into the gathering night of the plaza. But the cruel stripe had whipped my memory, and suddenly I remembered, not his name, that escaped me still, but everything else. He must have recognized me, for I have not changed very much in 20 years, and that was why, after the first morning, he had never paused in front of my table. Yes, it was 20 years since I had known him. I was spending a winter in Rome, and every evening I used to dine in a restaurant in the Via Sistina, where you got excellent macaroni and a good bottle of wine. It was frequented by a little band of English and American art students, and one or two writers, and we used to stay late into the night engaged in interminable arguments upon art and literature. He used to come in with a young painter who was a friend of his. He was only a boy then, he could not have been more than 22, and with his blue eyes, straight nose, and red hair, he was pleasing to look at. I remembered that he spoke a great deal of Central America. He had had a job with the American Fruit Company, but had thrown it over because he wanted to be a writer. He was not popular among us because he was arrogant, and we were none of us old enough to take the arrogance of youth with tolerance. He thought us poor fish and did not hesitate to tell us so. He would not show us his work because our praise meant nothing to him, and he despised our censor. His vanity was enormous. It irritated us. But some of us were uneasily aware that it might perhaps be justified. Was it possible that the intense consciousness of genius that he had rested on no grounds? He had sacrificed everything to be a writer. He was so certain of himself that he infected some of his friends with his own assurance. I recalled his high spirits, his vitality, his confidence in the future, and his disinterestedness. It was impossible that it was the same man, and yet I was sure of it. I stood up, paid for my drink, and went out into the plaza to find him. My thoughts were in a turmoil. I was aghast. I had thought of him now and then, and idly wondered what had become of him. I could never have imagined that he was reduced to this frightful misery. There are hundreds, thousands of youths who enter upon the hard calling of the arts with extravagant hopes, but for the most part, they come to terms with their mediocrity and find somewhere in life a niche where they can escape starvation. This was awful. I asked myself what had happened. What hopes deferred had broken his spirit? What disappointments shattered him? And what lost illusions ground him to the dust? I asked myself if nothing could be done. I walked around the plaza. He was not in the arcades. There was no hope of finding him in the crowd that circled round the bandstand. The light was waning, and I was afraid I had lost him. Then I passed the church and saw him sitting on the steps. I cannot describe what a lamentable object he looked. Life had taken him, rent him on its wrecks, torn him limb from limb, and then flung him, a bleeding wreck, on the stone steps of that church. I went up to him. "Do you remember Rome?" I said. He did not move. He did not answer. He took no more notice of me than if I were not standing before him. He did not look at me. His vacant blue eyes rested on the buzzards that were screaming and tearing at some object at the bottom of the steps. I did not know what to do. I took a yellow-backed note out of my pocket and pressed it in his hand. He did not give it a glance, but his hand moved a little. The thin claw-like fingers closed on the note and scrunched it up. He made it into a little ball and then, edging it on to his thumb, flicked it into the air so that it fell among the jangling buzzards. I turned my head instinctively and saw one of them seize it in his beak and fly off, followed by two others screaming behind it. When I looked back, the man was gone. I stayed 3 more days in Veracruz. I never saw him again.